You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical and American. We are here. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent. With me is...
Associate Editor Deep Tran.
I'm Susie Evans. I'm the Managing Editor.
Good to all be here. We're together after a little bit of travel. Deep, where were you this past weekend?
I was in Louisville for the Humana Festival.
Nice.
Of New American Plays.
And you're traveling to another festival to play soon, too.
Yes, Pacific Playwrights at South Coast Rep in Southern California. I finagled that one out of Susie because I told her I only need $300 because my parents live there.
Yeah, well, it's good to have housing.
Exactly.
I'm going to the Nashville Rep's Ingram New Play Festival in mid-May, and I've got a friend who lives there I haven't seen in a long time. So, you know, we do a little our own personal Airbnb.
My brother lives in Chicago.
There you go, and you're about
to go. Going to Chicago.
Next weekend, is it?
Or? Next weekend, yeah. I'm going out for about 5 days. I'm going to stay with one of our freelancers and maybe crash with my brother. So, you know, Airbnb-ing it around the U.S.
Great. Yeah, it is a time in which we just put out our May-June issue, a double issue. And it's a little bit traditionally at American Theater, slightly slower time than usual. We don't have an issue to put out right away. We don't have a June issue. So, as I've mentioned in the podcast before, we do have a website that that's going to keep going strong, even while there's not a print issue. Speaking of our website, recently we've shared some things that have been popular. Judith Malina, co-founder of the Living Theater, died. And there was a wonderful piece by Karen Malpede looking back on her legacy. Another one that we published was a piece by Jay Holtham, who's a playwright. Might be best known...
Formerly a playwright.
Yeah, well, get to that. He might be best known for founding the New Black Fest, and he worked at EST and was a new dramatist for a while. He was a TCG fellow, in fact. But it's a piece about how... He, although he's only in probably around 40 or late 30s, has retired as a playwright. And it's kind of in a genre piece that I goodbye to all that kind of piece. But it's really painfully honest and I thought gorgeously written. And it's gotten a lot of social media shares. So I think he's still going to. He's still a creative writer. He's writing screenplays, but it's not quite the direct I'm selling out to go to Hollywood story. It's a little more painful and convoluted than that. So
I think
definitely
it's
worth a read.
Yeah, I think it's like touching on a lot of thoughts that have been in the ether as of late in terms of compensation and equal representation. And so when you don't have equal representation, like certain playwrights aren't as produced as much, and so therefore it's not a level playing field for everybody. And
well, certainly he says that he made about $15,000,
yeah,
from playwriting in 2 years. Which is obviously not even
possible. It's not a sustainable profession.
Not a sustainable profession.
Yeah.
It's interesting because he confronts head on. He certainly mentions about access and representation, but he does confront head on this idea like, was I that good? People said I was good, but really very, very few theaters wanted to produce me for whatever reason, structural reasons. I think it just, it was a heartbreak aired for the theater world to see, and it was a brave piece, and I'm glad you wrote it. So hopefully we'll publish some first person pieces about people who love to be playwrights, and
we
certainly do plenty of those too.
The piece that he wrote kind of reminded me a little bit about Deep's piece about playwright compensation. When Playwrights Horizons announced that health insurance initiative, it was just bringing to the forefront the idea that this is a profession that it's incredibly hard to make a living in. I mean, I would almost argue that it's easier to make a living as an actor than as a playwright, because if you act in something and you're a professional actor, you're getting paid a weekly rate, but playwrights often get paid like a lump sum, or they should just be lucky that their work is getting produced. And
right. I mean, the only way that they really make a go of it, as Deep's piece touched on as well, is they sort of swim in this commissions, awards,
Which is why people that have been produced on Broadway are still called emerging sometimes, because you can only get an award if you're an emerging playwright.
Right.
Which is why Rajiv Joseph is still an emerging playwright.
He got the Lawrence Hatcher Award, which is for emerging playwrights.
Did he really?
Rajiv Joseph has stuff on Broadway.
Yeah, I think he's emerged. It's funny. My friend Mark Armstrong runs the Mid-Career Playwrights Project at Keene Company, and they've sort of recognized that there are a lot of playwrights who are in sort of mid-career age who don't qualify for emerging playwrights grants anymore, but still need support and places to read their work, just like new playwrights do, because they're not being produced a huge amount. So that's exciting. Speaking of new plays, a little slight debate broke out on our Facebook page. We were announcing lots of seasons this year. We've talked about Philadelphia Theater Company has a season of all what I would call new American plays. Ike Holter's play, the name escapes me, Exit Strategy, which was in Chicago. And a handful of others, Lucas Nath's play, Hillary and Clinton, which will have another production, so it's not the world premiere. Basically, none of them are world premieres at this Philadelphia Theater Company, but they're all plays that have disgraced as one. That won the Pulitzer 2 years ago. It's not an old play. I would still call them new. I think in the context of reporting on plays and the way plays are marketed, new play is supposed to mean brand new play, right? So I went back and forth with some of the commenters who said, this is misleading. I said, well, you know, I still think a play should be allowed to be called new when it's a couple years old. People talk about a new miracle drug. They don't mean it just came out on the shelf today. Or people talk about a new song. It could be the song of the summer.
When it's new to a specific market.
Like, it was also new to a specific market.
I wrote up this season recently for Tut's Underground, Theater and the Stars Underground, and all of the musicals they're premiering are Houston premieres, and they're all fairly new. Heather's the Musical, Bonnie and Clyde.
Right.
I mean, Bonnie and Clyde was on Broadway 2 years ago, but...
It's four years ago.
Lies.
No, I had to look that up, too. I felt like it was only 2 years ago.
But it's no one in Houston has ever seen it.
No. No, I thought about, is the word contemporary better? But I think contemporary almost sounds like it could have been all the way back to 2000.
It could have been, you know.
Like, what designates new? Is there like, a year? Like, how old? Like, it needs to be, like, less than 5 years
old? Yeah, like,
old?
Is God of Carnage new? No, probably. You can't call
it new. Bonnie and Sonia and Mosh and Spike new still, though.
Yeah, I would say so.
2 years old.
I would say so. Anyway, people joked, said, like, until it's been covered by American theater, then it's not new anymore. So, okay. All right. Well,
same goes for playwrights, too.
Who's emerging and who's
exactly.
Mid-career.
It kind of reminded me of that debate. So I still want to hold on to the right to use new play to describe plays that are... It's also because the whole issue of what is a premiere and a world premiere or a rolling world premiere, there's such a chase for the world premiere. And I think there's also a need for plays to get second and third productions. And not just rolling world premieres where the writers... working on it, but just, you know, a play that people like and they pay the writer to put it on. There's value in that. And I think, you know, none of Ayad Akhtar's plays are not new. He started writing these plays a couple years ago and they're all new plays. And they're new to most of the country. So I will stand by that decision. I would say maybe Annie Baker's first play, Body Awareness, is not new, but the rest of her plays are.
I wouldn't call Circle Mirror Transformation new.
No,
I wouldn't call The Aliens new.
No, me neither.
Interesting.
They don't get produced as often these days, but they're.
I think they were. They came out what, like 6 or 7 years ago.
Were they produced a lot then?
So maybe 5 years is our window.
Five years is the window.
I wouldn't call 4,000 Miles new.
You wouldn't call 4,000 Miles new.
I wouldn't call it new.
Huh?
That was like four years ago.
That's only 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Bad Jews is new though.
All right, so I've seen this. It's all about. It's all relative.
It's a Facebook
kind of
question. We should put.
Well, I did put it on Facebook.
What defines a new play?
And that's where people said, "Until American Theater covers it." Or, you know, so.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying about world premieres. It's because I remember when I was researching my playwrights compensation piece, and I can't remember which source told me, but when someone said that theaters use world premieres as a way to fundraise when they're writing grants.
Right. Yeah.
But then no one gets any money for putting on the second or third production of the
play. We have a bias that we always have to check.
Oh yeah, we love news stuff.
Well, it's just newsworthy. It's literally in the name of what news. If a theater puts on second and third productions of plays, we may not jump to it as quickly as we would if it's like, oh, it's a brand new play from Matthew Lopez, or it's a brand new play from.
Well, a lot of times there's co-productions, like something like, I'm thinking about Rollin Jones's These Paper Bullets, which premiered at Yale Rep and now has, not a co-production, but it has a production at the Geffen that has a production at Atlantic. We will probably cover those productions, like.
We will? We already covered it.
I don't know. I feel like it's still buzzy that it's coming in.
I would say, for instance, Ike Holter's play in particular. He's a really hot playwright that Chris Jones has written about from Chicago. That play has only had one production. I think I'm arguing right now. I'm just having a pitch meeting here on the air. The Philadelphia Theater Company production of Exit Strategy. We should probably write about that because we didn't write about it before.
We've never written about Exit Strategy?
Exit Strategy? Yeah. Ike Holter's play? I don't think so.
Apparently it's an amazing play.
Well, we should write about it.
We should write about it.
Like, sometimes I love the photos of it, too.
Sometimes you don't get to the world premiere just because sometimes you don't know if it's very good because you don't know who the playwright is at the time.
And the one benefit to covering the non-world premiere, we can have photos.
Yes. If there are photos, you get bigger placement in the magazine.
I'm writing about A. Ray Pamatmat's play that I didn't even know had a world premiere in Wisconsin. It has a big production coming up in Huntington. And I was like, oh, my gosh. Look at this. We have photos.
Exactly. You're hearing how the sausage gets made here.
Yeah. And we can cover Milwaukee in the process, which works out well.
I will mention one other news item I wanted to just point out. The Stage Raw Awards were this week. That's in Los Angeles. It's a new online publication that started up with some funding from, I think, a Pasadena Arts Council. And it sort of takes up where the LA Weekly left off. Stephen Lee Morris is still the LA Weekly's theater
critic.
Writer, critic. I don't think he's the editor anymore. But he's also the founder of Stage Raw. And anyway, the LA Weekly Awards were like the Obies of LA, and they ended last year. So the Stage Raw Awards are a new version of that. They were on Monday night. Right now, I won't bore you with all the details. We've written about it a couple times. The Equity has put forth a proposal to basically end the 99-seat plan, a sort of kind of a showcase code that allows Equity actors to work for almost nothing there, basically volunteer their work. Equity wants to end that. They put out a vote to their members. There was a lot of talk of that. It was basically a pro 99-seat rally, from what I understand, which is great. Tomorrow is the we're taping on the 16th. Tomorrow, the 17th, is the date when all the ballots have to begin. All the members have voted. Then these national counselors, these mysterious people who have been elected by Equity from all around the country, will vote. And supposedly next Tuesday, we will know what Equity's decision will be on this. The vote is what they say advisory, which means they can look at it and go, all right, you don't like it, we're still going to do it. It's non-binding, as they say.
Well, it's going to be a good news week next week because Monday the Pulitzer announcement comes out, and then Tuesday's Equity.
What if they gave it to a
99-seat
playwright? No, they probably won't. I don't know.
Who's going to get the Pulitzer, though? That's interesting. There's a lot of talk about Suzanne Laurie Parks and Brandon Jacobs Jenkins.
That's what a lot of the talk is, yeah.
Yeah.
Robert Simonson asked me for the playbill, and I gave him some. I think Lucas Nath for the Christians. No, they don't usually give stuff to Humana plays, but
I think it could be nice the Christians. Totally,
it could be a change
if he submitted it, because people are talking about like which year, because Appropriate wasn't submitted.
That's right.
The year it was at Humana, it was submitted. The year it was
so at you can never know.
Yeah, so you can never know what was submitted.
That's true, but we're talking Appropriate by Brandon Jacob Jenkins, not Octoroon, right? Because Octoroon's not.
Well, Octoroon could be because Soho Rep was last year.
It is, yeah.
Well, but do they give it to things that were based a parody / satire / half the text is from another play?
That's interesting. But I think that piece is a theater piece that's pretty much original.
Stands on its own. Yeah. I mean, people are talking about Appropriate more than Octoroon for Pulitzer, but
it does feel like a more like a Pulitzer type of play. It's white people.
Yeah, but I mean, if we're talking about it,
I'd love to then give it to black people. Plays about black people.
Exactly. Well, it's written by a black writer, but it's white people on a couch. Speaking of which, I actually think Young Jean Lee might have a shot. That was a breakthrough play for her.
Straight White Man?
Yes.
But it opened this year, didn't it?
End December.
It opened
of 2015.
End of December, and I think you could mark its premiere at the Wexner Center, I think. But anyway,
Very exciting
news week to look forward to. The end of LA Theaters, we know it, and the Pulitzer Prize.
So check back on our website for more details.
So, Deep, you went to Humana.
Humanity.
And you saw 5+ shows, 5-6 shows?
Seven.
Seven shows.
7 in 3 days.
7 shows in 3 days. That's unhealthy.
I still haven't caught up on my sleep.
Well, we'll ask
you. I'm still functioning.
You talked to a playwright whose play was not there.
Mm-mm.
But he happened to be hanging around.
Exactly.
And there was a party to launch his new theater company, right?
Yes, yes. I grabbed Rollin Jones in the lobby at Actors Theater and like took out my recorder and asked him about his new theater company. So Rollin Jones is a Pulitzer finalist in 2006 for the intelligent design of Jenny Chow.
Right.
And then he abandoned us so that he can go write for television on this little show called Weeds.
Right.
And then he recently signed a 2-year development deal with 20th Century Fox to develop television shows. And with that money, he also created a theater company with Jackson Gay, the director of These Paper Bullets. Rollin wrote that musical with Billy Joe Armstrong. It's getting produced at the Geffen and Atlantic next year. And it also includes, you know, Kelly Miller, the former literary manager at South Coast Rep. Mm-hmm.
She's working with Rollin at their new, like, TV gig, right?
Right, right. I remember when she announced that, she said she was going to be working with him on film and theater projects, but maybe...
Yeah, well, they're going to do TV projects, music projects, theater projects.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so she's the only...
Stephen Padlock, don't forget.
And Stephen Padlock, the...
Yale Rep.
Press Rep.
Press Rep for Yale Rep. Well, the only... Most of them are... These people live in different parts of the country, and so they're only going to come together on a project-by-project basis.
Okay.
And so... That's new and exciting, and we basically just talked about why he's doing this and what he's working on next and these
great.
Paper bullets.
Let's go to the Rollin interview. When we come back, we'll talk about which plays you liked at Humana and for recommendations.
Great.
Over to you.
Why you're back? Where'd you go?
Oh, that's
why'd you leave in the first place?
I was not leaving. I constantly had to go. I was at the computer, and I would write things, and they would normally be narrative-based things for actors. I didn't go off and write a novel. I didn't go write poems or anything like that. Kept writing for actors.
But on television.
Yeah, on television. Well, slightly different. It pays a livable wage. You get really terrific actors. You can write adult stories, and they make it, as opposed to movies anymore. You actually write it and they shoot it, so you get to see it. So that
as
part
is
to plays. No plays. You can get. I think you can get your plays done too. But like, in that part, they're similar though. You want to write something so that actors can speak it and someone sees it.
Mm-hmm.
So television was really nice that way. And I might have taken one job, but for the most part, you take jobs that like I was thrilled to write for, and it's also for me. This will probably spin its way into this new theater company. Very collaborative because you're not writing alone. You're writing with a group of people. I hate myself. I don't want to spend any time with myself. It's miserable trying to generate something by yourself in your ivory tower. So you come to work every day with a bunch of lovely writers, and it feels a little bit like grad school, like my experience at Yale. So that it's very comfy and seductive in that way. And I met a lot of lovely actors and writers that way, and it's a good life. And it's always been dramatic. It just hasn't necessarily been for the theater. But then I got roped back in, for crying out loud. God damn it. Oh, well.
Who was it, Billy Joel? Was it James Bundy? Like, who
was it?
That?
Who were the people? Okay, so I would say Frank Rich is one of the people that got me back. Seriously. I was hanging out with Frank. We were going to do one of these TV pilots for HBO. And we went to go see a bunch of plays just to go talk. It was like, oh, I'm going to go talk with, you know, go see plays with this great, lovely, lovely guy who at the time had been doing the Lord's work for the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
So he got me. That was just nice to have some conversations that way. And then probably Christian Parker at the Atlantic dusted off one of my old musty plays and dragged this old stupid-ass role into every play. But probably also thank you to Neil Pepe for that season. I think there were like five really, really depressing plays, and then there was my stupid roller derby play. And so that helped that there was just a little, there was a spot for it. And Jackson and me were having such a good time on it at the time. Mrs. Jackson Gay, delightful Jackson Gay. Let's wait a moment.
That's the sound of exciting theater announcements right now.
And people going to see theater.
They are excited and hungry for it. Some people are in love. There might be new love. There's some old friends that are walking by right now. It's just a nice swath of humanity.
Humanity.
back to the entire narrative. So Jackson, while we were doing the jammer, went up to Yale Rep, and I think they asked her to. We wanted you to do a Shakespeare play, and she pitched four like dramas, and they sat there stone faced and silent. And they said, "What about a comedy?" And she got back on the train, and she came back, and she's like, "What Shakespeare? I don't know anything." So we got drunk for two nights and came up with a big idea. And then, in some weird way, like a TV thing, we pitched it to Yale Rep. We're like, here's what it is. They're not four guys coming back from war. They're four lads who just conquered America, and four lads from Liverpool, blah, blah, blah. Did it. And then they said, well, how quickly can you do it? We're like, how quickly do you need it? And so we put on a big, dumb musical within 9 months. huge. Yeah. 19-member cast.
And Billy was involved from the beginning,
no,
or was he?
No.
He wasn't there when you pitched it.
When we pitched it, said we need to get somebody to write the songs. So I was like, yep, we do. I think we made a list of like the usual suspects a little bit. And at the time, I was beginning to. They were asking me to think about writing the American Idiot screenplay.
Yes.
I was like, I'll just send him an email. He's not going to want to be involved. I'll just do it. And I sort of sent him an email, told him the big dumb idea. He's like, yeah, I'll totally do it. This is great. Blah, blah, blah. And then he hung up, and I was like, oh.
So was he like, I've always wanted to write Beatles-esque music?
Well, there was the whole. You know, you never know with Billy, who is really one of the, and this is not just, you know, the old smoke up your ass. He's a really lovely, sweet man. Mm-hmm. Very approachable. When you can get him, because it's a rock star world, so generally speaking, you got these little pockets where you get full attention and then off into the, you know, the nexus. And so I was very suspicious of his yes. I was like, I'm going to fly up to Oakland and sit down across from him and ask him if you really want to do this. I told him that he was, you know, it was going to be for regional theater and you're never going to make a dime. And I'm going to rewrite Shakespeare and you're going to rewrite the Beatles. And are you interested in that? And he said, yeah. And literally, like, about 7 days later, I got an email. It was the first song. And he had literally gone into his home studio and had laid down the bass line and laid down the drums and laid down the guitar and laid down his lead vocals and backup vocals all by himself. And zipped it off to me, and I had the first song. I was like, whoa, that was pretty impressive. So at that point, I really had to write the play. And so, yeah, I don't know. It was mostly I had missed the camaraderie of it all. Had a really good time with the jammer. And then when we did this, had a really supremely good time, because the Yale Rep let us cast every fucking broken toy from off-Broadway, and we smashed them all together. It was a lot of ham. A lot of ham on one stage, and they were very, very generous to each other. A lot of fun, and really fun after rehearsal too. There was a fair amount of alcohol consumption. We did a lot for the local economy in New Haven.
a lot of ham, a lot of Quaaludes, a lot of wigs.
Yeah, there was some jocularity there, and it was the best time I had had in a decade. And that was a sort of a clear signal to me that I should probably do more of that.
Yes, yeah. I feel like we've been waiting for you to come back.
Oh, really? Was that what it was? The American Theater was starving? The other thing that was very helpful, my buddy Adam O'Byrne was doing a play at ACT, and Mark Rucker was around, had been hanging out, and he was like, you know, I was just talking to my friend Rollin Jones, and Mark Rucker goes, yeah, Rollin Jones, whatever happened to him?
Yes.
I think that was like, I think I wanted to make a t-shirt out of that. Mark Rucker, like this.
Yeah, so. That one play then just disappeared, like all the other playwrights. Yeah. Where do they go?
They go where they go. You know, I'll be very honest with you. I'm a much better TV writer than I am a playwright. There's
really?
No doubt about it. Oh, yeah. I'm really good at that job. And this one is always harder, and I knew I was never really a pure playwright. I always have to have some stupid shit going on in these plays. They really don't have the courage or the talent to write a play with two people sitting on a couch talking. I can't talk like that. I'm not good enough like that. So
I think people don't want to see those kind of plays
well,
anymore.
Then that's good because I'm not going to be that player.
Or you can do it ironically. People have been doing like a lot of ironic plays.
No, I don't want to see that. I think the truth is I've given a great gift to the American theater that I did not make them suffer through 7 years of bad, crappy plays that I didn't believe in. No one ever had to pay a dime for something I didn't think was like worthwhile seeing. So there were, you know, for that the hinterland, I have sitting even on my laptop as we speak, that is back in my hotel room, there are 3 half plays that are written. And awesome. I don't want to see them. So I'm not going to make anybody else see them right now.
What are they about?
The one that's really, like, actually, like, literally there is a half a play done was about a beat cop in the 50s who gets in a little bit of trouble in Brooklyn and gets thrown to the, while he's being investigated, while there's an internal affairs thing about this shooting that happens, he gets thrown to the theater district at the time, and amongst the shit-eating jobs he has to do there, he has to make sure that this one particular actor gets home from the bars late at night. And it's Jason Robards doing, while he's in previews where's my brain? I had 3 drinks.
I had one.
No, for Long Day's Journey. And it is a exceptionally well-written first act about a well-written play, and I hate those plays. It's just one of those things, the preciousness of the theater, and here's the dumb cop who's going to teach him a little bit about the scene that he's having a hard time with. I think ultimately it was a play about drinking and about these two guys who had gone to war. Because, like, Robards was actually at Pearl Harbor. There's a lot of interesting things about it, but it was just one of those plays that, like, was clearly made to go with Broadway for the thing and please people on the West Side. And it was just like, why are you writing this thing? You don't really believe in it. That, and in the second act, they really needed a live horse, the actual horse that had to be on stage. And no one's going to. Anyway, I didn't believe in it. I still don't believe in it, even though I think I wrote a really good first act of it. But, you know, that didn't get me, like, the dumb thing we did in New Haven with this dumb Much Ado About Nothing, and it is, by the way, an epically dumb play. I had more fun, and I thought it was more truthful and authentic than that thing that has arguably bigger ambitions or something like that.
It's you doing your Gene O'Neill.
Yeah, you play all you were doing was playing with that what would the brothers sing. So that's the thing you're kind of going back to over and over again. It's so ridiculously like well made play that it's offensive. The truth is the gift is no one is going to have to suffer through that play, and I feel really like I've done a service to.
Unless there's someone listening who says, oh, I really want to see Rollin Jones' take on Long Day's Journey.
By the way, if you are that person right now who is sitting there listening to this podcast and that, I want you to stop everything. I want you to call your closest companions and change your life because it's not right. Something right now is not going well for you. That is not saving anybody. You do not want to see that. Who knows? Maybe when I'm 55, I'll pick it up again.
Mm-hmm. You're like the one playwright who says, do not see this. This is stupid. Why are you wasting your money, American Theater?
Yeah, well, look, we've got a big dumb show coming up. We're going to do it at the Geffen at the Atlantic again. And it's got eight crazy songs by a big old... it's got costumes, huge rock star involved. We have a pound for pound amazing, amazing cast of really, really funny people.
Is it the same cast going?
Mostly, yeah. We're probably gonna. There's some one or two Atlantic actors that are being involved, but everyone's been great. Like Geffen, by the way, has been super, super cool. It's like a Yes First theater. They are bringing an entire East Coast cast over, and all my designers and everything. They really believe in the show that that we want to put on, and super cool also because I'm an Angeleno and never had a real big old fat production in Los Angeles, so that's kind of groovy.
That's your debut.
And the dirty secret, I'm just going to spread it out right now. Here's one of the dirty bits. Ooh. Amy Levinson, because this is going to be a saucy, exciting podcast, I can feel it right now. Amy Levinson is a lit manager there, and basically she's also half running that friggin' place. Mm-hmm. But we went to our first Broadway tour together, and Dirty Secret, we totally made out. We totally made out as high schoolers. We're there. So there you go. I don't know if that got me to get my play up at Geffen, It might have, who knows, but it's
been. Isn't that the dirty secret of any theater relationship? Didn't someone make out with someone
Make out
else?
With somebody else? Well, hopefully, okay. Right? Just, what else
like
are we doing?
Close quarters.
Nobody's getting paid, so you might as well be having a lot of strange, you know. But that was pure. We were like, I was 15 years old. It was cute. You know, I was walking around with my Driving Miss Daisy sweatshirt, you know, like, you know, really. I bought a Driving Miss Daisy sweatshirt, and I wore it around school. That was me. Yeah, that's who I was.
Oh my God, you were that kid in high school.
I was that kid. Yeah, I was the, you know, the with the John Cryer, Pretty in Pink, dark kid or whatever. Okay.
Would he be proud of you now?
John Cryer from Pretty in Pink?
No, your 15-year-old self.
Oh, wow. That's a whole nother, you know, at that point, I had just gotten kicked off my basketball team. And I wandered around sixth period and I wandered into like a rehearsal of Pippin. And there were a lot of gay guys and a lot of straight girls. And I was like, you know what? This might work for me, man. I might not have to work so hard. So that's, I was still in that mode where I was just like, what is this? What is this nonsense?
I always wonder why more straight men aren't into the theater, just because that's where all the women are.
There are, yeah. There are a lot of, well, it's a particular type of woman, though. You know, it's not, you know, it's not the cheerleader. It's usually a Band-Aid on the knee, and they're smart, and they're interesting. And,
okay, good, because I was about to get offended.
No. They're just, they're, you know, it's, a, you know, this, the drama kids are all, I mean, you know, whatever. Whatever genitalia they have, there's a certain type, you know, in high school.
But so. Eager to please people and
yeah, like, put on a show. We're not, you yeah. know, like what are you going to do? My brothers were all like big, heavy. They liked a lot of drugs, and so my rebellion was to do no drugs and to throw straw on the ground and put on a show. So lame. I missed out so much fun. Oh my God, what happened?
And that's why you're back here.
That's why I'm back. I am back here because. About a year ago, I had a really, really good time in New Haven with a lot of really exceptional, cool people. I went to a pilot in London, which was really super fun. It did not go as it were, but
you're developing.
Most of the time, I was thinking about what a great time I had in New Haven while I was doing it. let's face it, I took the money, a big, lovely overall deal with a terrific company. All my generative writing right now is for them. So I've like put on a little producer hat, started this theater company, and sort of, it's another way I can, you know, hopefully kind of have a foot in, and a more aggressive foot in. The company's called New Neighborhood. I don't even know if we've even said that yet.
No, we haven't. Yeah. I was going to set up the contacts, but I figured.
Yeah, we'll just jump right in.
Yeah, we'll just jump in.
Oh, wait.
They're doing it
another
again.
Exciting theater moment. Hold on. Let's see what's going on.
In case anyone's wondering, we're in the Actors Theater of Louisville lobby.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's what's going on. We're like sitting right outside of the people who haven't bought tickets who are thinking they might get in because some people didn't use their tickets. It's a hot theater weekend here in Louisville.
It is.
It's the center of shit.
And have you been here before? Oh, yeah. What?
I did a bunch of, like, way back in the day, I did one of the 10-minute plays, and then
yes,
they asked me back twice for the Apprentice show because I apparently I'm a whiz bang at the old 10-minute dumb. It's literally just like the Jammer. It's usually they get the playwrights who are very serious and they have many things to say, and then they're like, whoa, we better get Jones in there to have some dumb ass thing on a surfboard or I come to get the things that keep the people awake or something. So
liven up the proceedings.
Yeah.
Well, one of these days, we'll tell Les to like get you back here with Eugene O'Neill play.
No one's ever seen that. No. But there will be more theater work for me without a doubt. I had a really great time. I think I kind of know what I want to do in it too. You know. So
wait, do you have a commission?
I have a commission at Yale rep.
Okay.
I think the longest running outstanding commission at South Coast rep. God bless those people. They are so patient. I may actually deliver that 30 years from now.
How
great.
Long has it been?
It's been a long, long time. It's been, I think, over a decade now. And now I just send in money as a donation just to say I'm sorry or whatever. So I'm like I'm a donor to the theater, and that's mostly guild money.
Or interest money.
Yeah, that's right. They have gotten more money from me than they've given me. So it's already they're making money. because I believe in that. So this is outstanding commissions. But now I got to meet me and Jackson Gay and Jen Tiger and Kelly Miller and, you know, 30 other, you know, dumbasses have a big old theater company now. Yeah. So we have to, we are resume and experience rich and content poor right now. A little cash poor too, but we're getting through this first season that way. And so that stuff has to be written.
Well, I've read the new neighborhood mission statement. And
non-mission statement, or whatever it is. Because someone forced me to write that thing, yeah.
Well, as a theater company, it's kind of a requirement so people can know what it is that you
Is it a requirement?
Doing.
Does anybody really want... Ugh, I don't know. All
it's
of
like,
it.
Why do you exist?
Yeah.
Why do you exist, Roland?
Well, what did you think with that stupid thing? Did that answer any questions, or it just confused you more?
And I was pretty confused.
Yeah, embrace the mystery. Embrace the mystery. Who knows what you're getting? So, you know... Here's the guarantee. If you don't have a good time at one of our shows, you can write me. I will pay you back for any time, the time and the ticket price that you spent. Done. That is my guarantee. If you didn't like what you came, we're not going to bore you. It might not be your cup of tea, because I don't think we are going to be everybody's cup of tea. We're not interested in people. The asteroid is coming. You know, it's coming. It's going to come and crash and kill us all. I would like to help to provide a couple of nice, lovely hours here and there. So if we failed in that, I'll pay you back money-wise. There you go. That's what we'll do.
Well, 20 cents for Fox is very generous.
It's not that generous. Don't think it's like, no.
No, Rupert Murdoch isn't just like giving you money.
Oh, wait. Ooh. Oh, the first call.
This is your first call. You have 10 minutes.
So exciting.
So much theater.
Yeah. A fistful of theater. Maybe that's the title of this podcast, A Fistful of Theater.
No, or it's going to be Rollin Jones. I don't want you to see my play.
People can come to see these paper balls. You are allowed to see that. Permission granted to see that stupid thing.
Well, I did see it at Yale.
Oh, did you? What did you think of that thing?
I think...
She didn't like it. It wasn't for her.
It needed more music.
It did need more music. Well, I'm glad you said that. Because it isn't that weird thing where it's not... You know, it's not ever going to be a musical. We've sort of based it on, if we're actually being very authentic, we're basing it on Hard Day's Night. We're sort of using that. And that's a show, that's a movie that has 7 songs, actually. And the action stops and they play it. And that the music needs to come from the band. And so, but what shows that songs that we had buried on record players and on jukeboxes in that original are now going to be performed live. So we had 5 when you saw it. We'll have 8 now.
That's exciting.
Sparse that. Yeah. And we cut it down because we were fat, let's face it. We only had 9 months to do this thing. So we were at 19 actors, now we're at 15. We actually lost one scene completely, and every scene got whacked. We're thinner. We're not the beautiful hour and a half rock and roll show that it probably wants to be, but that's because I'm stuck with this stupid play that William Shakespeare wrote a long time ago, which is... an agonizingly, very strangely structured, strange ass show.
God, I've seen that thing twice plus yours.
Yeah.
Ours
is more fun.
Yes,
yeah.
I do agree. The thing is, I really love that you shout out how stupid that ending is.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, you got, I mean, the truth is, the playwriting task there was mostly problem solving. If you think that's the only problem in that play, you have not read that play.
Oh, no, it's one of the many problems of that play, but that's like the most glaring of the problems.
There's a lot of, I mean, that's, you know, clear. That seems to me to be like a play that had these really great Beatrice and Benedict scenes, and then a bunch of garbage surrounded it because, you know, someone was like, hey, Bill, you know, we got people coming to the theater like 2 weeks. You might want to just kind of get some stuff in the people's mouths. And
it's going to be 3 hours. You got to fill that up.
Yeah, man. So, you know, it's the meanest and leanest Much Ado you'll ever see.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. And see, it's gotten even leaner. And we have different, we have a different scale that I think it's going to be a little more stripped down. Because we're doing it for the Atlantic stage. They're a 200-seat theater. And we're also doing it, so we're re-engineering it for the Geffen. So we will probably design for the Atlantic, and then we'll start at the Geffen. And so all the bells and whistles we could have at the Geffen, we're probably not going to have in the show. So it'll be more about the actors and more about the, you know, and we'll have, we're using a lot of elements. Yale Rep was really, and the Finger Center were very gracious. They've enhanced this production. It's one of the few places that does a show and then gives money for its future, which is pretty cool, pretty smart. So there's a lot of the costumes will still be there, a lot of the props, but we're having a radically different set. And arguably, there's some pretty plush seats over there in Westwood. Those are some comfy seats. So.
Oh, yes, I remember those seats.
That's right. So that's the other thing. If you don't enjoy the play, you can still get a nap at the Geffen because those seats are comfortable, man. It's really nice. Yeah, they have a nice courtyard, mm-hmm. too. You know.
I think the Washington Post ran a story about people napping in the theater.
Yeah, and did they talk about the Geffen?
No, they just talked about how generally it's seen as bad form, but sometimes it's unavoidable.
Yeah. By the way, I don't have a problem with it. It's like just come in, come as you are. I just, it's a rough life out there. You don't know the story they come in with. You try to grab them in the first 10 minutes, but some of these things are. It's a sleepless man. If a sleepless man comes in, and all he wants, and this gives him his and his date is like thrilled to see it, and he gets a nap. I think that's successful. I think that's great.
Yeah.
I'm all for that kind of theater.
Well, I didn't nap during your show, but then again, I have full night sleep beforehand.
Oh, so what? So you were nodding off a little bit?
Oh no. The music helped.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's why I like musicals though, because if I start They're to doze fun. Off,
yeah, yeah.
then it's like big drum solo, and then okay, I'm up again.
The best things about this show are the actors, the designers, and the songs. The playwriting does what it can. It's the band-aid to all of it, but it's, look, I'm not going to, don't, yeah, there you go.
Wait, so new neighborhood, migrant theater company,
yeah.
People from around the country, and you'll have an actual building. And
Who wants a building? Who wants a building?
No one wants a building.
There's many buildings. Of course, we have this great, beautiful regional theater system all over the place, and then we got all these site-specific things that you can do.
Yes.
Who needs to be spending the limited money that you're that you have out there on light bulbs and on crazy infrastructure? And you know, we were sort of already looking into the old 501(c)(3) thing, and then every single time we broke down, it was like, okay, so we're gonna have to raise this amount of money just to pay the people that are helping us raise the money, and then it's like, what is that? So we got a different way of going about it, but we are an independent thing. And we'll probably be using like certain entities that allow you to fundraise project to project.
Yes, I was wondering about that.
Yeah,
because I read a thing where it says Yale is the entity, like the fundraising entity that you're underneath, so that you can fundraise.
It's not Yale. No, there's
okay,
a couple of like organizations
okay.
Out there. We're trying to figure out which one's the best that have their own organization. That if you raise through them, you have a project in mind.
Mm-hmm.
They'll take 6%. And if you look at that compared to what it would take to do a 501(c)(3), and clearly the gifts of our particular company, this is probably better. And that just makes helps us get more of the money into the actors and designers' hands and onto the stage itself. So that seems like a smart move right now for us.
Like less infrastructure and more.
I think so, especially because we're like, you know, everybody's got full careers. It's not, I mean, it's, for some reason, this first year, and again, we didn't exist 3.5 months ago, so the fact that we have 3 shows and a concert series coming up, it's a little faster than I think I wanted to do it, but yeah, it's still, everybody has careers, so it's very hard to kind of try to manage all that, so it's a lot of delegating, it's a lot of like, okay, this is my project, go run with it, and everybody just gets out of everybody's way, so it's really kind of structured to not have to have 30 people on a conference call or 30 people answering an email. It's more like go work, and then talk to me in 2 weeks and see where we're at. And then carving out the little times and spaces where we can all be in the same place. And a lot of it is finding a project that you like and the exact right place to do it. So we got really excited about the idea of like zipping all over the country. This is a particular project. This would be great there. And then finding a theater and kind of partnering up in the same spirit that we do. We can't do it on our own. And so we like to kind of invade and you know, I don't know, link arms or share beverages, whatever
share shitty resources,
yeah, whatever shitty metaphor you want. And no, we don't have a ton of money right now, but we probably come with a little bit of enhancement. And my guess is probably our trick for the first couple of years is that, you know, a good regional house that links up with us artistically. They're that moment where they're doing their season, the 5th and 6th show. The money's straining a little bit, and if we can come and maybe add a little bit, so they can move some money over to a show that's needful. You know, potentially that's a nice thing that would be there. But mostly, we just want to The other way to do this is to everyone for us to all pool our money together and find some storefront theater and nobody's ever going to go see it. We have really fat resumes. We have a lot of people who've been doing this for 10 years.
Yes.
And a lot of mid-career theater artists in this company. They're really talented and they're really gifted, and it would be a waste to try to find out where we can go ahead and let these people do really good work. And so that means probably audience theaters that have subscription audiences and a little bit of money. Because we're an ambitious company, there's we're not doing a lot of two-handers. and so we need spaces and we need design opportunities and things like that. So
wait, but you'll have a co-producing credit on Paper Bullets.
We don't. Well, we have an interesting relationship. So the truth of that is it's an expensive show.
Yeah.
And two theaters are coming together to co-produce it, and Yale Rep, because there's so many of the elements of that and that they have this enhancement money, it is the Yale Rep production.
Yes.
Because it really is. So for the most part, it is super, super nuts. Each theater will be adding a little bit new to the show, so that everybody should take a lot of credit by the time it's in New York. And then my guess is, that our company will probably be throwing in a couple of dimes and nickels there too. We'll probably be the least funded out of the four. And we weren't formed as a company when we did the show, but everything that is involved in that show is in this company now. So
it
is. It's delicate. No, I mean, Yale Rep deserves all the credit for hustling to try to get this, and the Geffen and the Atlantic taking a risk to a certain extent. I mean, it's Billy Joe Armstrong. That dude's going to sell some tickets.
Colin Jones.
Yeah, I'm not selling much. I get my family in. There's eight tickets there.
Pulitzer finalist Rollin Jones. Yeah. Oh. I feel like that
That was the year when they didn't even win. Nobody won anything because we all stunk. That's why. We were one of those lousy years. Jesus, Not taking any credit for that. God bless whoever thought, but that was clearly a weak year, right? If the Pulitzers know what they're talking about. So we have a co-production sort of full status. But in the end, all of that, with the Berkshire Theater Festival, we're doing this terrific new play by Suzanne Heathcote, who is this apparently hard-drinking British woman who's now living in Los Angeles. I have yet to see the evidence of the hard-drinking. And she wrote a play about wintry Illinois, and you'd have no idea because the ear is really so excellent that this woman is British. She wrote a very American play. And they had a lot of elements that, in a much smaller scale, that were good for our company. Ability for some live scoring, some design elements. It's like it's our winter play. It's really wintry, so we're going to lean into the winteriness of this, and that'll be its own sort of aggressive aesthetic. And it was good. There's good part. It was a really good part for Kieran Naughton, who's in our one of the actors in this company. I don't know. We could suck. We could go there and screw it up. I don't think so. It's a really, really crack cast, and Jackson Gay hasn't done a stinker in, 10 years. So I don't even know if she did one even 10 years ago. She's the best.
Well, the thing is, no theater company is normal if you don't have a stinker. But you want the room to be able to fail a little bit if you're going to.
No, we're so old. We shouldn't be failing.
Perfection all the time.
No,
kicked out.
No perfection. That's the other thing. Go look at our resumes. There's no perfection anywhere there. What there is solid B+, A- shit all the time. A lot of craft. A lot of craft. So the whole idea about billing and all that stuff, we could probably care less. What we really like to do is have jobs for these actors, and an audience to see them. Maybe later on when we're big and old and dumb, we'll get all feisty about billing and stuff like that. But mostly just a bunch of jerks who want to drop down in some city or some place and transform it a little bit and do some good, bury a couple bottles and leave, and with some good feelings all around. We'd like to be – it's really important to us that whoever we go and partner with, that we perform in a way that we're very, very easy and likable and understand it's a very stressful thing. And we'll figure out how to do high art by also being kind and being generous and keeping it fun. Fun. F-U-N, man.
So that's why there's no, set designation for it.
What do you mean? I'm the crossing guard.
Official theater designation.
Yeah, these are new. These are new designations. We are a new neighborhood, and we all have neighborhood jobs. Jackson's what, the greengrocer, I think, and we have a werewolf, and we have a sign painter, and we have all that stuff.
A karaoke
host. Yeah. No, you know, I think yes, that was probably a deliberate attempt for us to say hierarchy is not a real big priority for us, and that, you know, people were swapping hats. I'll probably do some directing. We have a our lighting designer, Paul Whitaker, is actually doing the set for Suzanne's play. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a little more loosey-goosey in that way. It has to be, because we don't live in the same place, and we don't have a building. And it kind of just takes the onus off it, though. I mean, everybody gets these jobs and this hierarchy or whatever. That's just, you're already putting the clock on how quickly you're going to burn this fucking thing down. And so we're just keeping it a little more. Nobody cares, too, anymore. We're just too old. Nobody gives a shit. Nobody thinks we're going to be famous or take over the world or anything like that. We want to hang, and we think we're good.
And we'll put together shows.
And we think, I think it's a really, really very, very talented group of people. I feel supremely confident that we will, we'll put on some really good shows.
Yeah. Is it doubling as a TV production company? Is that what I read?
That is part of the thing. I've spent some time in TV. I have some cred, not a lot, but a little.
Just this little show.
Yeah, my guess is if I'm something that I will develop for Fox, if it gets the good fortune of going on TV air, you will see a lot of our actors and a lot of those people involved in that show.
Okay.
We're also thinking about doing some album recording. We are also thinking of buying a racehorse and a bar, too. These are all just as serious as anything else. We have a concert series with the Petersons, which was this theater band that used to play in a lot of cabaret spaces in New York. And wherever we're doing a show, they will come and land for two nights and do a new separate concert show that will sort of be connected to that. Well, again, the neighborhood comes in. We're not just giving you a play. We're giving you we're just giving you a weird month that just comes in. Just blows
party?
In that way. Yeah. It's a little bit of that. There's some rambunctiousness in that fall. I mean, we're all a little bit old. It's not like it's all super rock and roll or anything like that.
Well, we do have a party tonight until 4 a.m.
There's a 4 a.m. Well, A, you don't want to, like, step on all the glorious, lovely work that's going on here. You kind of want to give them all the, you know, we'll see if anybody wants to burn it down late. And we'll see how much energy these people have. But they worked really hard, and we thought it was a cool place to sort of make our little announcement. We didn't want to kind of take away any glow, so we're the super late thing. And for the most part, we're not doing any, there's not a lot of activities. Mostly it's just a lot of drinking, a lot of hugging, a lot of shaking hands and stuff, because it felt like we were probably going to want to utilize this lovely regional system that's out there. We're not really interested necessarily in getting it to New York and all that stuff, so it seemed appropriate to be here on this weekend. So I don't know. We found a great bar, too. It was Bar Meta. And then, like 2 days ago, the bartender, or the guy who actually owns the bar, his sister was singing in there. And has this unbelievable voice. Like, you will not believe this crazy voice. And so she's going to go, we just grabbed her and said, what do you cost? And we're paying her tonight. She's going to sing, too. That's totally, by
the
way.
Bring her in. Bring her into the
that's
room.
That's what it is. If you see something you like, I mean, I will not be surprised in 4 years if we're building, like, some public art installation. It doesn't really have to be theater. It's to be a little bit of storytelling. It has to be a little bit about whatever this vibe is that we're sort of working on. And if it just seems like it's a worthwhile thing to do, you know, hopefully that'll keep it fresh and dynamic, and we'll build a little bit of a repertoire, but also kind of go, we did that 3 years ago. No one needs to do that anymore.
So you take commissions.
The only thing we've commissioned so far is the Petersons.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll probably do one. I mean, right now we just don't have the capacity to do much more than maybe two shows a year. Except that we'll keep rotating. So the shows that we're doing this year, we're doing new productions of it. We're kind of, you know, building up. So we probably could do up to four shows a year, but a new small one every year, and then a big one every 2 years, I think, is what it is. We'll probably commission. But right now we're kind of looking at what we'd like to do is have these three shows, have some playwrights that we like come see the shows so they can get a little more familiar with the ensemble and the design people, so that inspires them a little bit. I think it's probably bad money to go say, hey, just write what you want to do, and then we can't actually help. So I would love to commission a writer who's like, oh my god, those actors are in that show. I would kill to write for those actors, and maybe that'll be a good situation. Okay. And that's just going to go through the gauntlet of Jennifer Kiger, Jackson Gay, and Kelly Miller. They're going to be like, you know, gatekeepers, and that, you know, and then there'll be some Venn diagram that says, ah, that's the person. Right. We do. We got our. We have favorites, but Suzanne, I know her. I know her from Shinola, man. We read 55 plays, and that was the one. We read some good plays, mm-hmm. but there were plays that maybe we couldn't do very well. And this was one we were like, oh, this fits. This works. And so that's been super cool. She's been great. So who knows? Who knows what wanders in through the crack in the window?
Well, if anyone wants to send a play to Kelly, her email address is on the website.
Yeah,
and she has
yeah.
a very good eye, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we'll try to get back to you in a reasonable hour, or save yourself and take your play elsewhere. Because, like, God, man, you may not want to hang with us. We're idiots, man. We're idiots. So there's that. There's that too. I don't know. What else you got?
That's all.
That's it, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Did we say anything really provocative? I don't know.
I don't think so. No. You know, but then
another podcast failure. There we go. All right.
I mean, unless you have like any, you know, scandalous story.
That's one of the failures of the company. It's not built to have messy relationships. So hopefully you'll come see the show and we'll have inspired something so that people in the audience will like look across. They'll either look at the person they went on the date with and was like, I'm not. No way. Not anymore. And they'll call up the person they're supposed to be with, or they'll just spontaneously start making out in the audience. That would make me very happy. That would be the evidence that we were doing something right. You know, make some new love, man. You
know? Feed them booze. That's yeah. usually how it goes.
Well, that's one thing. But can we possibly become the R. Kelly of the American theater? That would be pretty cool, man. Where we're just like, we're the theater company that gets the drawers off, man. That would be mm-hmm. maybe that's it. We'll work on that.
Yeah.
Let's see.
New neighborhood, the R. Kelly of the American Theater.
And done. Podcast over.
All right, so we're back. And for our recommendations portion, we thought one of us has seen a bunch of plays recently, and it would be you, Dee. Mm-hmm. We've seen plays too, but tell us about Humana. What were your top two, or more, but your top two favorites there?
Yes, I can give you those. Yeah. My top two was The Glory of the World, the new Chuck Mee play that was directed by Les Waters.
Yeah.
But I really can't say that Chuck wrote the entire thing and Les just put on the production of it. Like, half of the stuff that was on that stage was in Les's head, because I read that script before I came, and
yeah.
I was just thinking, This is some of the craziest stuff I have ever seen.
Right.
Basically, the concept is 17 men. Like, I've never seen that many men on a stage that was not in a musical. Come on stage, and they host a birthday party for Thomas Merton, who is a monk / priest, wrote a lot of books. He lived in Kentucky for most of his life. And then it goes from this birthday party, then they start fighting with each other, like right. sword fights.
Like over the legacy of who Thomas Merton was and what he was about.
Yeah, yeah. Like yeah. verbal fights, and then it devolves into an actual fight with right. swords and plungers mm-hmm. and chainsaws. And then they start, and then at one point they're like flexing. They take off their shirts and then they start flexing on the stage.
This is a great tribute to a pacifist, right?
Basically, yes. And then they start slow dancing and then kissing. And then at one point, someone's singing like a slow rock version of Baby One More Time mm-hmm. while two guys like play on a slip and slide and in the background. And then
none of this is in the script?
No. And then the sad rhino just walks across the stage on a chain.
Wow.
So
not an actual rhino.
It was a rhino. And it was a big, full rhino puppet.
Okay, puppet.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I was going to say.
The budget at Actors Theater, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. that sounds like a Chuck Mee play. I mean, Chuck Mee's plays are give latitude for that.
Yeah, it's
Tina
like
Landau does that kind of thing.
Exactly. It's like absurd and ridiculous, but in the best way possible.
Okay. Well, speaking of which, I think your other top one had some absurd and ridiculous things in it as well.
Yeah,
in fact,
two.
Stuff inspired by the ridiculous theater.
Yes. Well, I'm actually going to do three things
I really loved.
But yeah, the other one I loved was also on the same vein. So Glory of the World is like an exploration of masculinity and gay identity and, you know, man stuff.
Man stuff, yeah.
And the Pig Iron, the new Pig Iron show that was at Humana, is going to get a production at Fringe Arts in Philly in May. And it's called I Promised Myself to Live Faster. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a gay space opera fantasia where this gay man who is going through a breakup travels through a glory hole into space where he has to retrieve the holy gay flame to save all the homosexuals in the universe.
You didn't mention the glory hole in your article.
What is a glory hole?
That's hilarious. Oh, Susie, we'll explain later.
Don't Google that.
Don't Google that word.
Friends.
That's pretty funny.
It is a hole of glory.
It's a hole of glory through its glorious thing.
I think I'm getting a good idea.
Yeah.
Let's just say a 5-foot dildo emerged through the glory hole.
Wow. Wow, that sounds like that sounds fun.
Yeah, but I did a Q&A with Dan Rothenberg about it, so you can read all about like why that.
Yeah, that's
was
online.
A
that's
thing.
Online. You're going to also write a wonderful piece for us about the entire experience. Now you mentioned there's a third one. You can talk about another one. It's
yeah,
okay. We have time.
Aaron Courtney's "I Will Be Gone." That was the straightest of the plays. Which, if you know Erin's work, you know that she doesn't really do typical plays. All of her plays are kind of odd in a weird way. Like her last one had singing ravens in it.
Right.
So, and this one featured ghost hauntings and Michael Jackson.
Right.
And just like it's about grief.
It's about grief.
And about a bunch of people who happen to live next to a ghost town.
A ghost town, yeah.
Yeah.
That's also, you can read about that, your Q&A with her online. All,
yeah.
You interviewed all the writers.
Yes,
like grief was a little bit of a theme at Humana with
grief and
Coleman's.
Death.
Yeah.
And a little bit of Jen Silverman's play, too.
Grief, death.
A little bit, yeah. More like grief, death, and gay.
And aging.
Grief, death, and gay.
Because Coleman's play was also talked a lot about gay culture as well.
Well, then I think I do see a theme emerging. So
there you go. We're helping you write your piece.
Exactly. Though I did ask Les Waters, the artistic director of Actors Theater, about it, and he said there's no theme; it just emerges organically. But
well, that's actually kind of a beautiful thing about when you put plays together in a festival is that themes mm-hmm. do emerge whether they're intended or not.
Exactly.
Resonances.
Like, one thing speaks to the other, yeah. And you can see a straight play about a gay couple, or you can go upstairs and see, you know...
A gay play about a straight couple?
A gay fantasy. It's out in outer space.
That sounds awesome. The pictures look really great, too. Susie, what do you have to recommend?
I'm going to recommend... I'm going, as we mentioned earlier, I'm going out to Chicago next weekend to see a bunch of shows. But one of the shows that I'm going to see is Carousel at the Lyric Opera of Chicago. It's a production directed by Rob Ashford and starring Stephen Pasquale and Laura Osnes. Mm-hmm. And a local radio station in Chicago does a lot of broadcasts of the Lyric's production. I think it's called WFMT. And they do it live on opening night. And so I was able to listen to it live on opening night. And there may or may not be recordings of that recording available for you online. I don't know if they're officially sanctioned, but it was a nice recording. So if you missed it, I'm not encouraging you to rip it off, but you might be able to find it on your own. But I'm really excited to see it. And it was just from listening to it on the radio, it was a gorgeous production and gorgeous singers, and there's lots of buzz about whether it's going to come to New York. We interviewed Stephen for our April issue for 20 questions, and he certainly has hopes for it. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing
the
that
director?
Rob Ashford.
Oh right, you mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So it's got really good reviews. Chris Jones got 4 stars on Tribune, and I think it's playing through May 3rd. So if you're in Chicago, go see it. And if you're not, maybe or maybe not, look for the recording from WFMT online.
The awesome. Big question though is how is the soliloquy?
Well, I listened to it on the radio, and it was really good. There was lots of applause. He holds that last note like he holds that note in Bridges. So
wow.
You saw Bridges, and you saw that it all fades away, but you know, memorable experience in Carousel based on audio alone.
Speaking of Broadway, My recommendation is Broadway, but this is a play which I think has a really good shot of not only doing well here, but actually you will see it in your town. Hand to God. I didn't know if I would love this show. I mean, I'm not someone who gravitates always to the most irreverent, rude humor, but it's really a wonderful show. I think the second act sags a little bit from but the first act is one of the most fun I've had in the theater in a long time. You know, you probably have read about it. It's about this teenage boy, supposedly teenage. Stephen Boyer does not really look teenage, but he's very convincing emotionally in the role, who has a puppet who is part of a puppet ministry that his mother has started in the basement of her Lutheran church. With a side note, I was raised Missouri Synod Lutheran, just like Rob Askins, which is a fairly conservative version of Lutheranism. Anyway, they don't talk that much about it, but there's a joke about, do Lutherans do exorcisms? Which I thought was funny. Anyway, this puppet seems to be, I mean, the premise is that everyone thinks it's possessed, and this foul-mouthed puppet kind of takes over this poor kid's life, wreaks vengeance on all the people in his life, including the bully, his mother. You know, it's a premise which I think in other hands would just be just gaggy and shticky. But it's really, in addition to being absurd and over the top and really, really blasphemous and profane, it's also really deeply felt, I think. The humor and the emotion comes from a real place. So that show, Stephen Boyer is definitely going to get a nomination for the Tonys. I don't know if he has a shot of winning it. It's not the kind of play that Tony voters are probably going to love.
I think Geneva Carr has a shot at a nomination, too.
The mom. Yeah. No, the piece was created for those two. I do think that, you know, Stephen Boyer's performance is the stuff of legend, but it's not like I can't see this play being done everywhere. Probably it's easy to imagine this play not being as funny as it is. Or before I saw it, it's easy to imagine a production which doesn't quite get all the layers and the humanity of it, but it's going to be at maybe not Broadway-sized houses. It's not going to go on a Broadway tour, probably, a bus and truck tour, but it's probably going to be in Chicago, San Francisco, L.A.,
totally.
Texas, where it's set. I could see this play. And again, I don't think it'll be on the top 10 list maybe next year, but
no,
I think this play
yet.
Will be produced
not
a lot.
Well, not yet. It can't be produced yet with all its songs.
Because a play this funny and this much fun and crowd-pleasing, you know, it reminded me a little bit of Lieutenant Inishmore in the sort of level of shock value they had, but
yeah, and I think we should also note that Hand of God's really easy to produce. I mean, it started at EST, which is a 99-seat black box, really small, and then it moved to MCC Theater off Broadway, which is bigger, I think about 250-seat house, and the cast has remained the same, I think, since MCC. I think there were a few different people
right,
at the EST,
EST
production,
yeah.
But it feels like the same production on Broadway, even though now it's at the Booth, which I think is about a 900-seat house. It's really great. It's easy to produce. And
there's a couple new lines I noticed when I would look back at the script in the Broadway one.
Mm-hmm. So here's a question though: which one's going to win Best New Play, Tony? That or Highway,
or Curious Incident, or
it's Curious Incident, a new play. Mm-hmm. Consider adaptations, new plays.
Yep, Curious Incident's the favorite to win.
Yeah, because I just saw Airline Highway, and it was talk about stories that don't get told very often.
Huh.
On mainstream theater, it's like, damn. Those are some messed up people.
I would love to see Airline Highway win Best Play and the Heidi Chronicles win Best Revival. I'd be like, booyah!
yeah, all ladies, right?
Only ladies on Broadway.
I was just going to say, I would push back on the idea that a play that's so reliant on those performances is, quote, easy to produce. I was just going to say, This Is Our Youth, didn't languish, but it was a sensation in the late 90s, and that's a three-character play.
Mm-hmm.
It got no productions, almost no productions, until its Broadway revival. And I think that has to do partly with the playwright.
The playwright is almost really stickler with that getting produced.
But other plays of his have been produced. Lobby Hero has been produced everywhere. I saw that twice in L.A.
Hmm.
So
really?
I would just say, I think one of the reasons is the cast was so much a part of it. And I think casting Hand of God, again, I can imagine some really bad productions of it that are just cheesy and shticky. I think it's certainly financially has a low overhead compared to a lot of other things you think of, but just producing it finding the right actress for those roles, especially
really,
the leads.
The Stephen Boyer role is the hardest to cast.
Yeah, exactly. Well, because he's got to be an amazing actor who can also do this puppet and be like two actors on stage.
Well, considering puppet theater is so big now, according to this big feature we're going to do in July, August, I'm sure there are like a bevy of
but
actors
can puppeteers
out there
can act
do.
As well as Stephen
yeah,
Boyer.
Yeah, this is the thing. Stephen Boyer was not a puppeteer at all when he was hired.
Well, the role was created for him.
Right, so... It's not like the puppetry is at a like world class level. It's just that it's
a sock puppet. I mean,
with a couple rods. Yeah, exactly. So it's great. Anyway, I think the play deserves all the success it can have. So that I think is a great place to stop our broadcast this time. It's great to talk to you both, and we'll talk again soon.